Snow Falling on Cedars, Disc 9.
Alvin Hooks called Army First Sergeant Victor Maples to the stand after that morning's recess. Sergeant Maples wore his green dress uniform and the insignia of the 4th Infantry Division. He wore his expert marksmanship and combat infantryman's badges. The brass buttons on Sergeant Maples' coat, the insignia on his collar, and the badges on his chest all caught the meager courtroom light and held it. Sergeant Maples was overweight by 35 pounds, but still looked distinguished in his dress uniform. The extra weight was nicely distributed. Maples was a powerful man. He had short, thick arms, no neck, and a pudgy adolescent face. His hair stood up in a razor cut. First Sergeant Maples explained to the court that since 1946 he had been assigned to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, where he specialized in the training of combat troops. Prior to that, he'd trained troops at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, before taking part in the Italian campaign in 1944 and 45. Sergeant Maples had been wounded in fighting on the Arno River. He'd taken a German round in the small of his back, which narrowly missed his spine, and had been awarded the Purple Heart on account of it. He'd also, he said, been at Livorno and Luciana, and seen the 442nd, the Nisei regiment to which the defendant had been attached, in action along the Gothic line. Sergeant Maples had, in his time, trained thousands of men in hand-to-hand combat. Hand-to-hand was his specialty, he said. He'd worked in other areas of basic training, but generally found his way back to it. Sergeant Maples recollected for the court his astonishment in early 1943 when the 442nd, composed of Nisei boys, began training at Camp Shelby. These were boys from the internment camps. Enlistees headed for the European theater, and among them, Sergeant Maples recalled, was the defendant, Kabuo Miyamoto. He remembered Kabuo from among the thousands who'd come his way because of a peculiar episode. 10 squads of trainees had surrounded Sergeant Maples on the drill field at Camp Shelby one February afternoon, 10 squads composed of Nisei boys, so that he found himself in the midst of 100 Japanese faces while he explained the particulars of the bayonet. Sergeant Maples informed his trainees that it was the policy of the United States Army to preserve their lives until they reached the battlefield. That was why a wooden staff would be substituted for an actual weapon during drill sessions. Helmets would be worn as well. The sergeant began to demonstrate bayonet thrusts, then asked for a volunteer. It was at this point, he told the court, that he came face to face with the defendant. A young man stepped forward into the ring of trainees and presented himself to the sergeant, bowing slightly before saluting and calling out loudly, "Sir!" "First off," Sergeant Maples scolded him, "you don't have to salute me or call me sir. I'm an enlisted man just like you, a sergeant, not a warrant officer or a major. Second, nobody in this army bows to nobody. There's plenty of officers who'll expect a salute, but a bow? It isn't military, not American military. It isn't done." Sergeant Maples gave Miyamoto a wooden staff and tossed him a sparring helmet. There was something aggressive in the way the boy had spoken, and Sergeant Maples had heard it. He was vaguely aware of this particular young man who had built a reputation during basic training as a thoroughly eager warrior, ready to kill and businesslike every bit of the time. Maples had seen many such boys come his way, and was never cowed by their youthful swagger. He was only on rare occasions impressed or prepared to view them as his equal. "In combat, your enemy won't be stationary," he said now, looking the boy in the eye. "It's one thing to work out on a dummy or a bag, another to spar with a trained human being who represents more accurately live movement. In this case," he told the gathered recruits, "our volunteer will seek to avoid the model bayonet thrusts put to him this afternoon." "Yes, sir," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "No more, sir," Sergeant Maples replied. "That's the last time with that." He explained to the court how astonished he was, how thoroughly astonished, to find he couldn't hit the defendant. Kabuo Miyamoto hardly moved, and yet he slipped every thrust. The 100 Nisei trainees looked on in silence and gave no indication that they approved of either man. Sergeant Maples fought on with his wooden staff until Kabuo Miyamoto knocked it from his hands. "Excuse me," said Miyamoto. He knelt, picked up the staff, and handed it to the sergeant. Once again he bowed. "There's no need to bow," the sergeant repeated. "I already told you about that." "I do it out of habit," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "I'm used to bowing when I'm sparring somebody." Then suddenly he brought his wooden staff up. He looked Sergeant Maples in the eye and smiled. Sergeant Maples acquiesced to the inevitable and did combat with the defendant that afternoon. It lasted all of 3 seconds. On his first rush, the sergeant was swept off his feet, then felt his head pinned to the ground with the point of the staff. Then the staff was withdrawn. The defendant bowed and picked him up. "Excuse me, sergeant," he'd said afterward. "Your staff, sergeant." He'd handed it to him. After that, Sergeant Maples availed himself of the opportunity to study kendo with an expert. Sergeant Maples wasn't stupid. He told the court this about himself without a trace of irony. And so he learned all he could from Miyamoto, including the importance of bowing. Sergeant Maples became a master with time, and after the war taught kendo techniques to the Army Rangers at Fort Sheridan. From his point of view, as an expert in the ancient Japanese art of stick fighting, Sergeant Maples could say with certainty that the defendant was eminently capable of killing a man far larger than himself with a fishing gaff. In fact, there were few men known to him who could ably defend themselves against such an attack by Kabuo Miyamoto. Certainly, a man with no training in kendo had little chance of warding him off. He was, in Sergeant Maples' experience, a man both technically proficient at stick fighting and willing to inflict violence on another man. He had made, the record showed, an excellent soldier. No, it would not surprise Sergeant Victor Maples to hear that Kabuo Miyamoto had killed a man with a fishing gaff. He was highly capable of such a deed. Chapter 20. Susan Marie Heine had been a widow for nearly 3 months by the time of Kabuo Miyamoto's murder trial, but had not grown very much accustomed to it yet, and still passed long hours, especially at night, during which she could think of nothing but Carl and the fact that he had gone out of her existence. In the gallery, with her sister on one side and her mother on the other, dressed in black from head to foot, and with her eyes shrouded behind a chenille dot veil, Susan Marie looked mournfully attractive. She exuded a blonde, woeful distress that caused the reporters to turn in her direction and ponder the propriety of speaking intimately with her under the guise of professional necessity. The young widow's thick hair had been plaited and pinned up beneath her hat so that the alabaster neck Art Moran so much admired when Susan Marie poured coffee at church socials lay exposed to the crowded courtroom. The neck and the plaits of hair and the white hands folded decorously in her lap all stood in sharp contrast to her black mourning outfit and gave Susan Marie the air of an unostentatious young German baroness who had perhaps just recently lost her husband but had not, in the face of it, forgotten how to dress well, even when she dressed to suggest grief. And it was grief, foremost, that Susan Marie suggested. Those who had known her for a long while recognized that even her face had changed. The superficial among them attributed this to the fact that she'd neglected to eat heartily since Carl died. Shadows had formed just under her cheekbones. But others recognized it as a deeper alteration, one that involved her spirit. The pastor at the First Hill Lutheran Church had on 4 successive Sundays asked his congregation to pray not only for Carl Heine's soul, but for Susan Marie's deliverance from grief in the course of time as well. In pursuit of this latter end, the church women's auxiliary had provided Susan Marie and her children with a straight month's worth of hot suppers and casserole dishes, and Einar Peterson had seen to it that groceries were delivered to her kitchen door. It was through food that the island expressed its compassion for Susan Marie in her widowhood. Alvin Hooks, the prosecutor, knew well the value of a Susan Marie Heine. He had called to the witness box the county sheriff and the county coroner, the murdered man's mother and the bent-over Swede from whom the murdered man had planned to buy his father's old farm. He had proceeded to a variety of secondary witnesses, Sterling Whitman, Dale Middleton, Vance Cope, Leonard George, Sergeant Victor Maples, and now he would finish matters by presenting the wife of the murdered man, a woman who had already done much good merely sitting in the gallery where the jurors could view her. The men especially would not wish to betray such a woman with a not guilty verdict at the end of things. She would persuade them, not precisely with what she had to say, but with the entirety of who she was. On the afternoon of Thursday, September 9th, Kabuo Miyamoto had stood at her doorstep and asked to speak with her husband. It was a cloudless day of the sort San Pedro rarely saw in September. This year there'd been an early string of them, though, a day of deep heat, but with an onshore breeze that tossed the leaves in the alders and even ripped a few loose to fall earthward. One minute it was silent, the next a rush of wind came up from off the water, smelling of salt and seaweed, and the roar of the leaves in the trees was as loud as waves breaking on a beach. A gust caught Kabuo Miyamoto's shirt as he stood on the porch so that the collar of it brushed his neck for a moment, and the shoulders ballooned out, filled with air. Then the wind died, and his shirt settled, and she asked him to come in and sit in the front room. She would go, she said, to find her husband. The Japanese man had seemed uncertain about entering her house that afternoon. "I can wait on the porch, Mrs. Heine," he suggested. "It's a nice afternoon. I'll wait outside." "Nonsense," she replied, and stepped aside from the door. She gestured in the direction of the living room. "You come in and make yourself comfortable. Get out of the sun and sit, why don't you? It's nice and cool inside." He looked at her, blinked, but took only one step. "Thank you," he said. "It's a beautiful house." "Carl built it," Susan Marie answered. "Please come in now, sit." The Japanese man passed her, turned to his left, and perched on the edge of the bench sofa. His back was straight, his demeanor formal. It was as if he considered making himself comfortable an insult of some kind. With a deliberation that bordered, to her thinking, on something stylized, he folded his hands together and waited at attention. "I'll go after Carl," said Susan Marie. "It'll only take me a minute." "Fine," said the Japanese man. "Thank you." She left him there. Carl and the boys were out culling raspberry canes, and she found them down among the southward trellises, Carl cutting free the older stock, the boys filling the wheelbarrow. She stood at the end of the row and called to them. "Carl," she said, "there's someone to see you. It's Kabuo Miyamoto. He's waiting." They all turned to look at her, the boys shirtless and small against the walls of raspberries, Carl bent at the knees, his knife in hand, a giant with a russet beard. He closed the knife and slipped it into the sheath at his belt. "Where?" he said. "Kabuo?" "In the living room. He's waiting." "Tell him I'm coming," said Carl, and he swung both boys into the wheelbarrow and planted them on top of the culled canes. "Watch out for thorns," he said. "Here we go." She went back to the house and informed the Japanese man that her husband would be with him shortly. He'd been out among the raspberry canes working. "Would you care for coffee?" she added. "No, thank you," replied Kabuo Miyamoto. "It's no trouble," she urged. "Please have some." "It's very nice of you," he said. "You're very kind." "Will you have some then?" Susan Marie asked. "Carl and I were planning on a cup." "All right then," said Kabuo. "Thank you, I will. Thank you." He was still seated in the same position, perched on the edge of the worn bench sofa, precisely as she'd left him minutes before. Susan Marie found his immobility disquieting, and was about to suggest that he sit back and relax, make himself at home, get comfortable, when Carl came through the front door. Kabuo Miyamoto stood up. "Hey," Carl said. "Kabuo." "Carl," said the Japanese man. They came together and locked hands. Her husband, half a foot taller than his visitor, bearded and heavy through the shoulders and chest, and wearing a sweat-stained T-shirt. "What do you say we go out?" he suggested. "Take a walk round the property or something, get out of the house, go outside?" "That sounds fine," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "I hope this is a good time," he added. Carl turned and looked at Susan Marie. "Kabuo and me are going out," he said. "Be back after a while, going to walk." "All right," she said. "I'll put coffee on." When they were gone, she went upstairs to check her baby. She leaned over the side of the crib and smelled the girl's warm breath and let her nose brush against the girl's cheek. From the window, she could see her boys in the yard, the tops of their heads as they sat in the grass beside the overturned wheelbarrow. They were tying knots in the culled raspberry canes. Susan Marie knew Carl had spoken with old Jurgensen and had put down earnest money on Ole's farm. She knew how Carl felt about the old place at Island Center and his passion for growing strawberries. Still, she didn't want to leave the house on Mill Run Road with its bronze light, varnished pine boards, and exposed roof rafters in the upstairs room, its view of the sea beyond the raspberry canes. From the window of her baby's room, looking out across the fields, it was more clear to her than ever that she didn't want to move. She'd grown up the daughter of a hay farmer and shake cutter, a man who couldn't get ends to meet. She'd cut thousands of shakes, had hunched over a cedar block with a fro and a mallet, her blonde hair hanging in her eyes. She was the second of three daughters and remembered how her younger sister had died of tuberculosis one winter. They'd buried her on Indian Knob Hill in the Lutheran part of the cemetery. The ground had been frozen, and the men had difficulty digging Ellen's grave. It had taken the better part of a December morning. She'd met Carl Heine because she'd wanted to meet him. On San Pedro, a woman with her looks could do such a thing if she did it with the proper innocence. She'd been 20 and employed at Larson's Pharmacy, where she clerked from behind an oak sales counter. One Saturday evening at 11:30, on a hill above the dance pavilion at Westport Jensen, she stood beneath the branches of a cedar tree while Carl ran his hands up under her blouse and caressed her breasts with his fisherman's fingers. The woods were lit with lanterns, and far below in the bay, through the interstices of trees, she could make out the deck lights of moored pleasure boats. Some of the light came to where they stood so that his face was visible to her. This was their third dance together. By now she knew definitely that she admired his face, which was large, weathered, and durable. She held his face between her hands and looked at it from a distance of 6 inches. It was an island boy's face, and at the same time mysterious. He'd been to the war, after all. Carl began to kiss her throat, so that Susan Marie had to throw back her head to make room for him with his russet beard. She looked up into the branches of the cedars and breathed in their perfume. And he moved his lips over her collarbones and then down into the space between her breasts. She let him. She remembered clearly how she had let him, how it was not resignation as it had been with two other boys, one near the end of her senior year of high school, the other during the summer before this one. But instead, intensely and deeply, what she wanted, this bearded fisherman who had been to the war and, on occasion, if she pressed him, spoke about it without exaggerating. She stroked the top of his head with her fingers and felt the odd sensation of his beard against her breasts. "Carl," she whispered. But there was nothing to follow that with. She didn't know what other words she wanted to speak. After a while he stopped and pressed his hands against the bark of the cedar tree behind her so that his blunt, muscled arms passed on either side of her head. He looked at her closely, with an intimacy and seriousness that did not seem to embarrass him, this somber man, then tucked a strand of blonde hair in behind her ear. He kissed her, and then, still looking into her eyes, unbuttoned two of the buttons on her blouse and kissed her again so that she was caught gently between Carl and the tree. She pushed back against him with the muscles of her pelvis, something she'd never done with a man before. It was an admission of her desire, a revealing of it, and it surprised her to the root of her being. Yet in another way, she was not surprised at all to find herself at the age of 20 pressing herself against Carl Heine beneath a cedar above the Westport Jensen Dance Pavilion. After all, she had brought this about, willed it into being. She had discovered when she was 17 that she could shape the behavior of men with her behavior, and that this ability was founded on her appearance. She was no longer astonished to look in the mirror and find she had developed the breasts and hips of an attractive grown-up woman. Her astonishment gave way quickly to happiness about it. There was a roundness and firmness to her, a clean, strong roundness. And her heavy blonde hair cast a glow over her shoulders when she wore a bathing suit. Her breasts turned just slightly away from one another and brushed against the insides of her arms when she walked. They were large, and when she got over her embarrassment about them, she was able to take pleasure in the fact that boys became unnerved in their presence. Yet Susan Marie never flirted. She did not let on she knew she was attractive. She went out with two boys before meeting Carl and insisted on their politeness and reserve. Susan Marie did not want to be, foremost, a pair of breasts. But on the other hand, she was proud of herself. This pride remained with her into her mid-20s, until she'd given birth to a second child, and her breasts were no longer so important to her as the most visible locus of her sexuality. Two sons had tugged at them with their gums and lips, and her breasts appeared different to her now. She wore a bra with stiff wire along its base in order to lift them up. Susan Marie knew, within 3 months of marrying Carl, that she'd made an excellent choice. In his grave, silent veteran's way, he was dependable and gentle. He was gone nights, fishing. He came home in the morning, ate and showered, and then they got into bed together. He kept his hands smooth with a pumice stone, so that even though they were fishermen's hands, they felt good stroking her shoulders. The two of them moved from position to position, trying everything. The sunlight just behind the pulled shade, their bodies moving in morning shadow but plainly visible. She found she had married an attentive man whose pursuit as a lover was to ensure her satisfaction. He read all her movements as signs, and when she was close to coming, retreated just enough so that her excitement became more desperate. Then it was necessary for her to put him on his back and rock high with her spine arched, while he, half sitting now, his stomach muscles clenched, stroked her breasts and kissed them. She often came this way, in control of her sensations, guiding herself along Carl's body. And Carl timed matters so as to begin to come while she was, and thus carry her back up, so that when she was through, she did not feel satisfied, and was compelled to press on toward a second coming that the pastor at the First Hill Lutheran Church could neither approve nor disapprove of, because, she felt certain of this, he had no idea that it was possible. Carl would sleep until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, then eat again and go out to work on the property. He was happy when she told him she was pregnant. He did not stop making love to her until she asked him to stop at the beginning of the 9th month. Sometime after their first son was born, Carl bought his own boat. When he named it for her, she was pleased and came aboard, and they took the baby out into the bay and west until the island was nothing but a low black line on the horizon. She sat on the short bunk nursing their son while Carl stood at the wheel. She sat there looking at the back of his head, his short tousled hair, the broad muscles in his back and shoulders. They ate a can of sardines, two pears, a bag of filberts. The baby slept on the bunk, and Susan Marie stood on a pallet board, piloting the boat while Carl, behind her, massaged her shoulders and the small of her back, and then her buttocks. She gripped the wheel more tightly when he lifted her skirt and slid her underpants out of the way, and then, leaning forward against the boat's wheel and reaching back to slide her hands along her husband's hips, she shut her eyes and rocked. These were the things Susan Marie remembered. In her estimation of it, their sex life had been at the heart of their marriage. It had permeated everything else between them. A state of affairs she sometimes worried over. If it went bad, would they go bad? Somewhere down the road, when they were older and less passionate, when their desire for one another had staled and worn out, then where would they be? She didn't even want to think about that or to mull how one day they might have nothing except his silence and his obsession with whatever he was working on, his boat, their house, his gardens. She could see her husband and Kabuo Miyamoto walking the border of the property. Then they went over a rise out of view, and she leaned down to stroke her baby's hair, so beautiful beneath her hand, and went downstairs again. In 20 minutes' time, Carl returned, alone, changed into a fresh T-shirt, and hunkered down on the front porch with his head in his hands. She came out with a cup of coffee in each hand and sat down next to him on his right. "What did he want?" she asked.
"Nothing," answered Carl.
"We had some things to talk about, nothing much, no big deal." Susan Marie handed him a coffee cup. "It's hot," she said. "Be careful."
"All right," said Carl. "Thanks."
"I made him some," said Susan Marie. "I thought he was going to stay."
"It was nothing," said Carl. "It's a long story."
Susan Marie put her arm around his shoulder. "What's the problem?" she said.
"I don't know," sighed Carl. "He wants 7 of Old's acres. He wants me to let Old sell them to him, or sell them to him myself, you know, step out of his way."
7 acres?
"The ones his family had. He wants them back. That thing my mother talks about."
"That," said Susan Marie. "I had a feeling it was that when he showed up."
"That,"
she added grimly. Carl said nothing. It was like him at a moment like this not to say very much. He didn't like to explain or elaborate, and there was a part of him she couldn't get to. She attributed this to his war experiences, and for the most part she let it be, this silence of his. But it irritated her at times. "What did you tell him?" she asked now. "Did he go off angry, Carl?" Carl set down his coffee. He leaned his elbows against his knees.
"Damn," he answered. "What could I tell him? There's my mother to think about, you know her. I have to think about that business. If I let him get back in out there..."
He shrugged and seemed hapless for a moment. She saw the lines the sea wind had etched at the corners of his blue eyes.
"I told him I'd have to think it over, have a talk with you. Told him how upset my mother was with him, about his dirty looks and mean faces. He froze when I brought that up. Real polite, but frozen. Wouldn't look at me no more. Wouldn't come back up to the house for coffee. I don't know. I guess it was my fault. We got into a scrap, I guess. I couldn't talk with him, Susan. I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what to say to him."
He trailed off. She recognized it as one of his moments, thought it over, and held her tongue. It had never been very clear to her if Carl and Kabuo were friends or enemies. This was the first time she had seen them together, and it seemed to her, it was her impression, that there remained some measure of kind feelings between them. That after all this time they held inside at least the memory of their friendship. But there was no way, truly, of telling. It could be that their cordiality and handshaking had been nothing but stiff formality, that underneath they hated each other. She knew anyway that Carl's mother had nothing but ill feelings for all the Miyamotos. She sometimes spoke of them at the dinner table on Sundays, rattling on obsessively. Carl generally fell silent when this happened, or agreed with her in a perfunctory fashion, afterward dismissing the subject. Susan Marie had grown accustomed to these dismissals and to Carl's reluctance to speak about the matter. She was accustomed to it, but it pained her. And she wished she could clear it all up right now, while they sat together on the porch. The wind came up and tossed the tops of the alders, and she felt the odd fall warmth in it. Carl had told her more than once, he'd repeated it just the other day, how since the war he couldn't speak. Even his old friends were included in this, so that now Carl was a lonely man who understood land and work, boat and sea, his own hands, better than his mouth and heart. She felt sympathy for him and rubbed his shoulder gently and waited patiently beside him. "Damn," Carl said after a while. "Anyway, I guess as far as you're concerned, I could hand the whole business over to him and let him do what he wants with it. I guess you don't want to move out there anyway."
"It's so beautiful here," replied Susan Marie. "Just look around for a minute, Carl."
"Look around out there," he said. "That's 65 acres, Susan." She understood that. He was a man who needed plenty of space, a vast terrain in which to operate. It was what he'd grown up with, and the sea, despite its size, was no substitute for green fields. Carl needed room. Far more room than his boat could offer, and anyway, in order to put his war behind him, the canton going down, men drowning while he watched, he would have to leave his boat for good and grow strawberries like his father. She knew this was the only way for her husband to grow sound. It was what made her willing, ultimately, to follow him out to Island Center.
"Supposing you sell him his 7 acres," Susan Marie said. "What's the worst your mother can do?"
Carl shook his head emphatically.
"It doesn't really come down to her," he said. "It comes down to the fact that Kabuo's a Jap. And I don't hate Japs, but I don't like 'em neither. It's hard to explain, but he's a Jap."
"He's not a Jap," Susan Marie said.
"You don't mean that, Carl. I've heard you say nice things about him. You and he were friends."
"Were," said Carl. "That's right, a long time ago, before the war came along. But now, I don't like him much anymore. Don't like how he acted when I told him I'd think it over, like he expected me to just hand those 7 acres to him, like I owed it to him, or—"
There was a boy's cry from the back of the house then, a cry of pain instead of argument or upset, and Carl was already moving toward it before Susan Marie could stand. They found their older boy sprawled on a flagstone with his left foot gripped in both his hands. He'd sliced it open against the sharp edge of a strut on the overturned wheelbarrow beside him. Susan Marie knelt and kissed his face and held him closely while his foot bled. She remembered how Carl had looked at the wound, tenderly, transformed. He was no longer a war veteran. They'd taken the boy in to Dr. Whaley, and then Carl had gone off fishing. The two of them hadn't discussed Kabuo Miyamoto again, and Susan Marie soon recognized that the subject was somehow forbidden. It was forbidden in her marriage to open up her husband's wounds and look at them unless he asked her to. Their marriage, she understood after Carl was gone, had largely been about sex. It had been about sex right up to the end. Until the day Carl went out of her life. That morning, while the children slept, they'd shut the bathroom door and pulled the latch and taken off their clothes. Carl showered, and Susan Marie joined him when the stink of salmon had been washed down the drain. She washed his large penis and felt it harden in her fingers. She put her arms around his neck, locked her feet at the small of his back. Carl held her up with his strong hands clenching the muscles in her legs and leaned the side of his face against her breasts and took to licking them. They moved that way, standing up in the bathtub with the water pouring over them, and Susan Marie's blonde hair pasted to her face and her hands clutched around her husband's head. They washed each other afterward, taking their time about it in the friendly way of certain married people, and then Carl got into bed and slept until 1 in the afternoon. At 2, having eaten a lunch of fried eggs and Jerusalem artichokes, canned pears and bread spread with clover honey, he went out to change the oil in his tractor. She saw him from the kitchen window that afternoon, gathering early windfall apples and dropping them in a burlap bag. At 3:45, he came up to the house again and said goodbye to the children, who were seated on the porch, drinking apple juice and eating graham crackers and rolling pebbles back and forth. He came into the kitchen, wrapped himself around his wife, and explained that unless the fishing was excellent, he was coming home early the next morning, would be home, he hoped, by 4 a.m. Then he left for the Amity Harbor docks, and she never saw him again. Chapter 21. Nels Gudmundsson stood at a distance from the witness stand when it was his turn to question Susan Marie Heine. He did not want to appear lecherous by placing himself in close proximity to a woman of such tragic, sensual beauty. He was self-conscious about his age and felt that the jurors would see him as disgusting if he didn't distance himself from Susan Marie Heine and appear in general detached from the life of his body altogether. The month before, Nels had been told by a doctor in Anacortes that his prostate gland had become moderately enlarged. It would have to be removed surgically, and he would no longer be able to produce seminal fluid. The doctor had asked Nels embarrassing questions, and he had been forced to reveal a truth about which he was ashamed, that he could no longer achieve an erection. He could achieve one briefly, but it would wither in his hand before he had a chance to take pleasure from it. The bad part was not really this, so much as it was that a woman like Susan Marie Heine inspired a deep frustration in him. He felt defeated as he appraised her on the witness stand. It was no longer possible for him to communicate to any woman, even those his own age he knew in town, his merit and value as a lover, for he no longer had this sort of worth and had to admit as much to himself. As a lover, he was entirely through. Nels remembered as he watched Susan Marie Heine the finest years of his sex life, now more than a half a century behind him. He could not quite believe that this was so. He was 79 and trapped inside a decaying body. It was difficult for him to sleep and to urinate. His body had betrayed him, and most of the things he once took for granted were no longer even possible. A man might easily be embittered by such circumstances, but Nels made it a point not to struggle unnecessarily with life's unresolvable dilemmas. He had indeed achieved a kind of wisdom, if you wanted to call it that, though at the same time he knew that most elderly people were not wise at all, but only wore a thin veneer of cheap wisdom as a sort of armor against the world. Anyway, the kind of wisdom younger people sought from old age was not to be acquired in this life, no matter how many years they lived. He wished he could tell them this without inviting their mockery or their pity. Nels's wife had died from cancer of the colon. They had not gotten along particularly well, but nevertheless, he missed her. Occasionally, he sat in his apartment and wept, in order to empty himself of self-pity and remorse. Occasionally, he attempted, unsuccessfully, to masturbate, in the hope of rediscovering that lost part of himself he deeply, achingly missed. He was convinced at rare moments that he could succeed, and that his youth was still buried inside of himself. The rest of the time, he accepted this as untrue and went about the business of consoling himself in various unsatisfying ways. He liked to eat. He enjoyed chess. He did not mind his work and knew himself to be quite good at it. He was a reader and recognized his habit of reading as obsessive and neurotic, and told himself that if he read something less frivolous than newspapers and magazines, he might indeed be better off. The problem was that he could not concentrate on literature, however much he might admire it. It wasn't that War and Peace bored him exactly, but rather that his mind couldn't focus on it. Another loss. His eyes provided him with only half a view of the world, and reading caused his neurasthenia to flare up and made his temples throb. His mind, too, was failing him, he felt, although one could not be sure of such a thing. Certainly his memory was not as good as it had been when he was younger. Nels Goodmanson tucked his thumbs in behind his suspenders and looked with studied detachment at the witness.
"Mrs. Heine," he said, "the defendant here appeared on your doorstep on Thursday, September 9th. Is that what I heard you say?"
"Yes, Mr. Goodmanson, that's right."
"He asked to speak to your husband?"
"He did."
"They walked outside in order to talk. They didn't speak in the house?"
"Correct," said Susan Marie. "They spoke outside. They walked our property for 30 or 40 minutes."
"I see," said Nels. "And you didn't accompany them?"
"No," said Susan Marie, "I didn't."
"Did you hear any part of their conversation?"
"No."
"In other words, you have no first-hand knowledge of its content. Is that correct, Mrs. Heine?"
"What I know is what Carl told me," answered Susan Marie. "I didn't hear their conversation, no."
"Thank you," Nels said, "because that concerns me. The fact that you've testified about this conversation without having heard any part of it."
He pinched the wattles of skin at his throat and turned his good eye on Judge Fielding. The judge, his head resting on his hand, yawned and looked back with detachment.
"Well, then," Nels said, "to summarize, Mrs. Heine, your husband and the defendant walked and talked, and you stayed behind. Is that right?"
"Yes, it is."
"And after 30 to 40 minutes, your husband returned. Is that also right, Mrs. Heine?"
"Yes, it is."
"You asked him about the content of his conversation with the defendant?"
"Yes."
"And he replied that the two of them had discussed the land in question, the land that your mother-in-law sold to old Jurgensen more than a decade ago, the land on which the defendant's childhood home sat. Is all of that right, Mrs. Heine?"
"Yes," said Susan Marie, "it is."
"You and your husband had recently put down earnest money on this land. Is that correct, Mrs. Heine?"
"Yes, my husband had."
"Let's see," said Nels Goodmanson. "Monday, September 6th, was Labor Day. Tuesday the 7th, Mr. Jurgensen put his land up for sale. Was it Wednesday, then, the 8th of September, that your husband signed the contract on Mr. Jurgensen's property?
It must have been, said Susan Marie. Wednesday the 8th sounds right.
And the defendant visited the next day, on Thursday, the 9th of September?
Yes.
All right, then, said Nels Goodmanson. You've testified that on the afternoon of the 9th, the defendant presented himself at your door, and that he and your husband walked and talked, but that you were not present during their conversation. Do I have that right, Mrs. Heine?
Yes, you do.
And furthermore, said Nels, after the defendant left that afternoon, you and your husband sat on the porch and had your own conversation?
Yes.
Your husband indicated an unwillingness to talk about the content of his conversation with the defendant?
Correct.
You pressed him?
I did.
He reported to you that he had indicated to the defendant a willingness to think matters over? That he would ponder whether or not he might sell the 7 acres to Mr. Miyamoto, or allow Mr. Jurgensen to do so?
Yes.
He reported to you a concern about how his mother might react if he sold to the defendant. Did I hear you say that, Mrs. Heine?
You did.
But he was pondering such a sale anyway?
That's right.
And he had indicated as much to the defendant.
Yes.
So, in other words, Mr. Miyamoto left your residence on the 9th. Having heard from your husband, there was at least a possibility your husband would sell the 7 acres to him.
That's right.
Your husband reported to you that he had encouraged Mr. Miyamoto to believe in such a possibility?
Encouraged? Replied Susan Marie Heine. I don't know about that.
Let me put it this way,
Nell said.
Your husband did not state an unequivocal no. He did not lead the defendant to believe that no hope existed for the reclaiming of his family's land?
He did not, answered Susan Marie.
In other words, he encouraged Mr. Miyamoto to believe that, at the very least, a possibility existed.
I guess so, said Susan Marie.
I guess you'd have to guess, said Nels, having not been present at their conversation. Having to report to the court only, Mrs. Heine, what your husband reported to you. Words that might not be 100% accurate, since your husband was aware of your disenchantment about the possibility of moving, as you've said, and may well have altered the tone and substance of his conversation with Mr. Miyamoto. Objection, put in Alvin Hooks. Argumentative.
Sustained, said the judge.
Stop rambling, Mr. Goodmanson. Your purpose here is to ask questions of the witness that refer directly to her testimony. You must refrain from doing anything else, but you know this. Get on with it.
Apologies,
Nels replied.
All right, then, Mrs. Heine, forgive me. Your husband and the defendant, do I have this right, had grown up together as boys?
As far as I know, yes.
Did your husband ever mention him as a neighbor, an acquaintance from his youth?
Yes.
Did he tell you how they'd gone fishing together as boys of 10 or 11, or that they'd played on the same high school baseball and football teams, that they rode the same school bus for many years, any of that, Mrs. Heine?
I suppose so, Susan Marie said.
Said Nels.
He pulled the wattles of skin at his throat again and gazed at the ceiling for a moment.
Mrs. Heine,
he said,
You mentioned during the course of your testimony these dirty looks Mr. Miyamoto is supposed to have aimed at your mother-in-law. Do you remember mentioning that?
Yes.
You didn't mention that the defendant had aimed similar looks at you, is that right? Do I remember right?
No, I didn't.
Or at your husband? Did I hear you say he aimed dirty looks at your husband, or is it just something your mother-in-law reported as having occurred?
I can't speak for either of them, answered Susan Marie. I don't know what they experienced.
Of course not, said Nels. And I wouldn't want you to speak for them either. It's just that earlier, when Mr. Hooks was questioning you, you seemed happy to do so, Mrs. Heine. So I thought I'd take a flyer myself.
He smiled.
All right, Judge Fielding interrupted. That'll do, Mr. Goodmanson. Get on with your questioning or sit down at once. Judge, replied Nels, there's been a lot of hearsay admitted as evidence. That bears pointing out.
Yes, said the judge. A lot of hearsay, hearsay you didn't object to, Mr. Goodmanson, because you know that Mrs. Heine is entitled under statute to report the nature and content of a conversation held with her deceased husband. The unfortunate fact is that he cannot do it himself. Mrs. Heine is under oath to tell the truth. As a court of law, we have no choice but to trust that what she tells us is accurate.
He turned slowly toward the jurors.
For want of a gentler title, the legal institution in question here is known as the Dead Man's Statute, he explained. Normally, it prohibits evidence from being entered into the record. It allows me to rule it inadmissible as hearsay because the individual in question is deceased. In criminal cases, however, the Dead Man's Statute does not bar such evidence from being presented, as Mr. Goodmanson well knows. Nevertheless, and quite frankly, the Dead Man's Statute creates a shady legal area. This is, I believe, what Mr. Goodmanson seeks to point out.
Yes, said Mr. Goodmanson.
It is precisely what I seek to point out.
He bowed his head to the judge, glanced at the jurors, then turned and looked fully at Kabuo Miyamoto, who still sat erectly in his place at the defendant's table with his hands folded neatly in front of him. It was at this moment that the courtroom lights flickered in the storm, flickered again, and went out. A tree had fallen on Pearsall Road and knocked the power wires down. Chapter 22.
Well timed,
Nels Goodmanson said when the lights went out in the Island County Courthouse.
I have no further questions for Mrs. Heine, Your Honor. As far as we're concerned, she may step down.
The four tall windows, frosted with vapor from the steam radiators, allowed a gray snowfall light to descend into the courtroom. Its timbre replaced that of the overhead lights and cast a subtle pall across the citizens in the gallery, who sat looking at one another and at the ceiling.
Very well, Judge Fielding replied. One thing at a time now. Patience, patience. Let's proceed methodically, lights or no lights. Mr. Hooks, will you redirect?
Alvin Hooks rose and told the court that the prosecution had no further questions.
In fact, he added, winking at Nels, the timing of this power outage is even more propitious than my colleague for the defense suspects. Mrs. Heine is our last witness. The state rests at the same moment the county's power supply does.
The jurors, some of them, stirred and smiled.
The state rests, repeated Lou Fielding. Very well, then, very good. I was, at any rate, going to call for a lunch recess. We will get a report from the power company and take matters from there. We shall see what we shall see. In the meantime, I would like to ask Mr. Hooks and Mr. Goodmanson to visit with me in my chambers.
The judge picked his gavel up and dropped it again listlessly against its walnut plate.
Go have lunch, he advised. If we begin again at all, we'll begin at 1 sharp, 1 p.m. according to my watch, which now reads, he peered at it, 11:53. The electric clocks in this building are useless, incidentally. Pay no attention to them.
Ed Soames held the door open for him, and Judge Fielding disappeared into his chambers. The citizens in the gallery filed out.
The reporters picked up their notepads. Soames followed the judge with the intention of lighting a pair of candles he knew to be lodged in the back of a desk drawer. Judge Fielding would need them, after all. It was dark in his chambers, darker than dusk, with only a pale light seeping through the windows. Ed had the candles lit by the time Nels Goodmanson and Alvin Hooks had arrived and situated themselves across the desk from Judge Fielding. The candles sat between them so that they looked like three men preparing for a séance, the judge in his silk robe, Nels in his bow tie with its touch of the theatrical, Alvin Hooks dapper and elegant, his legs crossed, one knee over the other. Ed made his way to the door and excused himself for interrupting. Was there anything more the judge required? If not, he would see to the jurors.
"Oh, yes," Judge Fielding answered. "Go and check on the boiler room, won't you? Find out how it looks to keep the radiators perking, and ring the power company and get a report, and let's see, scare up as many candles as you can find around."
He turned his attention to the attorneys in front of him. "What am I forgetting?" he added. "The hotel," Alvin Hooks answered. "You'd better ask about their boiler, too, or the jurors aren't going to make it. They didn't fare well last night, recollect, and with the power out, things will be worse."
"Right," Ed Soames said. "Will do."
"Very well, Ed," the judge returned. "Then, quite solicitous of you, Alvin." "I'm a solicitous man," Alvin Hooks replied. Soames went out grimly. The courtroom was empty except for Ishmael Chambers, who sat in the gallery with the look on his face of a man willing to wait forever. Eleanor Doakes had tended to the jurors. They were gathered in the anteroom, getting coats on. "The judge will be conferring throughout the lunch recess," Ed told Ishmael Chambers. "There's no point in waiting around to speak to him. An announcement will be made at 1 o'clock. The newspaper man stood and stuffed his notepad in his pocket. "I'm not waiting," he said softly. "I was just thinking about things."
"You'll have to think about them elsewhere," said Ed. "I'm going to lock up the courtroom."
"All right," said Ishmael. "Excuse me." But he left slowly, preoccupied. Ed Soames watched him impatiently. "A strange bird," he told himself. About half the man his father was. Maybe the missing arm had something to do with it. Ed remembered Ishmael's father and shook his head, disconcerted. He and Arthur had been friendly enough, but the boy was not someone you could speak to. Ishmael, with his shoulders hunched, his collar turned up, his pinned coat sleeve whipping in the wind, slogged through the snow to his office. The wind blew from off the water to the northwest and swept raucously down Hill Street. Ishmael had to keep his head lowered. When he raised it, needles of snow lashed his eyes. He could see, nevertheless, that there were no lights anywhere in Amity Harbor. The power was out entirely. Four cars had been abandoned at haphazard angles along Hill Street, and one near the intersection of Hill and Erickson had slid into a parked pickup truck, crumpling the driver's side rear panel. Ishmael pushed the door to his office open and shut it again with his shoulder. In his overcoat and snow-flecked hat, he picked up the telephone to call his mother. She lived alone 5 miles from town, and he wanted to see how she was faring in the storm and find out if the South End was in as bad a state as Amity Harbor just now. If she stoked it up and hung a curtain across the pantry door, the cook stove in the kitchen should keep her warm enough. The phone in his office was dead, however, and gave him back only a hollow silence. So was his printing press dead, for that matter, he realized now with a start. The office, furthermore, was quickly going cold, giving up its electric heat, and he sat for a moment with his hand in his coat pocket and considered the snow whirling past his window. The stump of his amputated arm throbbed. Or, more precisely, it was as if the arm were there again, but half numb, a phantom limb. His brain, apparently, did not fully grasp or still disbelieved that the arm was gone. At times past, just after the war, his missing arm had caused him a great deal of pain. A Seattle doctor had suggested sympathetic denervation of the limb, doing away with its ability to feel. But Ishmael had balked for unfathomable reasons. Whatever there was to feel in his arm, pain or anything else, he wanted to feel it. He didn't exactly know why. Now he reached up inside his coat, cupped the stump of his arm in his right hand, and thought of all he had to do on account of the power being out. He must see to his mother, first of all. He must use Tom Torgerson's ham radio set and put in a call to Anna Cortes about printing the paper there. He wanted to talk to Nels Goodmanson and Alvin Hooks. He wanted to find out if the Anna Cortes ferry was running and if the power company would project a time for getting the wires up again. It would be good to find out where the lines were down and to go out to wherever it was for pictures. It would be good to drive out to the Coast Guard station, too, and get a full storm report, the speed of the wind, the height of the tides, the rate of snowfall. He should probably take his mother food from town and a can of kerosene. There was a kerosene heater in the shed she could use to keep her bedroom warm, but it needed a new wick. He'd have to stop in at Fisk's. Ishmael slung his camera around his neck and shoved out into Hill Street to take pictures. Even in good conditions, it was not easy for him, a one-armed man, to steady his camera in the way he would like. It was a large box camera with an accordion apparatus for the lens, unwieldy and as heavy as a stone around his neck, and he disliked it thoroughly. When he had a choice, he bolted it to a tripod. When he didn't, he propped it on the stump of his missing arm, turned his head to look over his left shoulder, and got his pictures as best he could. Doing this always embarrassed him. Twisted and turned, the camera perched precariously beside his ear. He felt like a circus grotesque. Ishmael took three shots of the car that had plowed into the pickup truck. It was impossible to keep the snow off the lens, and after a time, he gave up trying. He felt certain that he should carry his camera, though, since a blizzard like this one did not come along often. The last had hit in 36, and was sure to do the sort of damage that constituted island news. Nonetheless, from Ishmael's perspective, this inclement weather should not be allowed to overshadow the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto, which was an affair of a different sort entirely, and of a greater magnitude. In the hearts of his fellow islanders, though, weather of this sort overwhelmed absolutely everything, so that even when a man stood trial for his life, it was no doubt the destruction of docks and bulkheads, the trees fallen on homes, the burst pipes, the stranded cars, that would most interest San Pedro's citizens. Ishmael, a native, could not understand how such transitory and accidental occurrences gained the upper hand in their view of things. It was as if they had been waiting all along for something enormous to enter their lives and make them part of the news. On the other hand, the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto was the first island murder trial in 28 years. Ishmael had looked it up in back issues of the review. And unlike the storm, was a human affair, stood squarely in the arena of human responsibility. Was no mere accident of wind and sea, but instead a thing humans could make sense of. Its progress, its impact, its outcome, its meaning, these were in the hands of people. Ishmael intended to lead with it, with the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto, if somehow he could get Thursday's edition printed despite the storm. He picked his way down to Tom Torgerson's filling station, where a half-dozen battered cars stood lined up along the fence, gathering snow on their hoods and roofs, while Tom backed yet another into place. "They're everywhere," he told Ishmael from the wrecker's window. "I've seen 15 alone on Island Center Road and a dozen more up on Mill Run. It'll take me 3 days just to get to them." "Listen," answered Ishmael. "I know you're busy, but I need to get chains on my DeSoto. It's parked up on Hill Street, and I can't bring it down to you. There are four stranded cars up there you'll need to move anyway. What do you say to heading up there next? I've got the chains sitting on the floor in the back seat. On top of that, I've got to raise Anna Cortes on your radio unless I can find a phone that's working. I've got no power to print my paper." "Whole island's down," Tom Torgerson answered. Nobody's got power or phone anywhere. There's trees across lines in 20 different places. Crews over on Pearsall now trying to bring town back up. Maybe by morning would be my guess. Anyway, okay, I'll get somebody on the DeSoto, but I just can't do it myself. We've got two high school kids working for us. I'll send one of them up, okay?
That's fine, said Ishmael. The keys are in it. Any chance I can use your radio?
Took it home last week, Tom answered. You want to head out to the house? That's fine. It's set up there. Lois will show you.
I'm heading up to the Coast Guard station. Maybe I'll get them to put a call through for me if your radio isn't handy.
Either way, Tom said, you're welcome to have at it. Like I said, just go on out to the house.
Ishmael made his way down Main Street to Fisk's, where he bought a 1-gallon can of kerosene and a wick for his mother's heater. Fisk had sold all of his size D batteries and all but one of his snow shovels. 3/4 of his stock of candles had gone out the door, and 4/5 of his supply of kerosene. Fisk, Kelton Fisk, had a highly developed sense of civic duty that had led him at 10 o'clock that morning to refuse to sell more than a gallon of kerosene to any one island household. He stood with his feet planted wide beside the pot-bellied stove, polishing his glasses on the hem of his flannel shirt, and, without having been prompted by Ishmael to do so, recited in detail an inventory of items that had gone out his door since 8 o'clock. He also reminded Ishmael that the wick he had purchased would have to be cut after 6 uses. Ishmael stopped in at the Amity Harbor restaurant and asked Alina Bridges to put 2 cheese sandwiches in a paper sack for him. He didn't have time to stay and eat. The restaurant, though half dark, was full and loud with conversation. People sat in booths and at the counter wrapped in coats and scarves, with bags of groceries underfoot, and turned their glances toward the snowfall beyond the windows. They were glad to have found a place to come in from the storm. Later, when they were done eating, it would be difficult for them to go outside again. Ishmael, waiting, listened to the conversation of 2 fishermen hunkered down at the counter. They were lapping up tomato soup that had been warmed on the gas stove and speculating on when the power might come on again. One wondered if high tide, with the wind behind it at 55 knots, might not swamp the town docks. The other said that a wind out of the northwest would bring down a lot of trees that were used to southerlies, including a white fir he feared mightily that grew on a bluff behind his cabin. He had gone out that morning and tied his boat off to a mooring buoy with tripled lines, and through his binoculars could see it from his living room swinging about when the wind gusted down the bay. The first man cursed and said he wished he'd done the same with his boat, which would have to take its chances moored on slack lines with 12 fenders out, 6 on either side. It was too tricky in these winds to move it. At 12:45, Ishmael stopped in at the office of the Island County Power and Light Company on the corner of 2nd Street and Main. He was loaded down now with the sack of sandwiches stuffed into 1 coat pocket and the new heater wick in the other, the camera dangling around his neck and the can of kerosene carried in his hand. The report, which had been posted on the door for San Pedro's citizens to read, listed Pearsall Road, Alder Valley Road, South Beach Drive, New Sweden Road, Mill Run Road, Woodhouse Cove Road, and at least 6 others as blocked by fallen trees that had brought down power lines. It projected that power would be restored to Amity Harbor by 8 o'clock the following morning and requested patience on the part of citizens. The repair crew had the help of the volunteer fire department and intended to work through the night, it said. All that could be done was being done as speedily as possible. Ishmael returned to the courthouse. He ate one of his sandwiches in the 2nd-floor corridor, sitting on a bench with his camera beside him and the can of kerosene on the floor. The corridor, he noticed, was slick with the snow that had melted from the shoes of passersby. Those who came down it did so carefully, treading their way like novice ice skaters. The only light was whatever passed through the windows of offices and from there through the translucent glass panels of doors. The same was true of the public cloakroom, a damp, slippery, dark place full of dripping coats, bags, hats, and gloves. Ishmael left his kerosene and his camera there on the shelf above his coat. He knew no one would steal the camera, and he hoped no one would steal the kerosene.
With the power out, the latter, he supposed, was suddenly a possibility. Judge Fielding's announcement to the gathered court was terse. The trial would adjourn until 8 o'clock the following morning, at which time the power company expected to have the lights on. There were high seas between San Pedro and the mainland that were preventing the Anacortes ferry from running, so it was not possible to house the members of the jury anywhere but where they had been housed the previous evening, the cold, dark rooms of the Amity Harbor Hotel, where they would have to make the best of things, since circumstances were now beyond Judge Fielding's control and other accommodations were not available. He hoped that the elements would not divert the jurors from the crucial and difficult matters at hand. They had an obligation, Judge Fielding said, to brave the storm and power outage as best they could in order to keep their minds fully on the facts of the trial and the testimony of its witnesses. The judge folded his arms in front of him and leaned from the bench so that the members of the jury could see through the shadows his shaggy, exhausted face. "The thought of a retrial makes me weary," he sighed. "I think that with a little effort we can avoid one, can't we? I hope you will pass a relatively pleasant night at the Amity Harbor Hotel, but if you do not, then be brave about it and return tomorrow with your thoughts centered on the case at hand. This is a murder trial, after all," the judge reminded them. "And snow or no snow, we have got to keep that foremost in our hearts and minds."
This ends Disc 9.